Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada. Today I get to interview someone who I had on almost a year ago. June 2021 was the last time I had the privilege to talk to Dr. Peter McCullough, but he's on with us again. Thanks for coming on, Dr. McCullough.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I need to hear some good news today. It's been great talking off camera for a little bit, Peter, and you seem to have got some insight for us coming out of the U.S. So in Canada, just as a brief update to you, we are in full lockdown. We still have businesses closed. We've got vaccine passports everywhere we can go. I'm not allowed to fly in the country. I'm not allowed to go on a train. I'm not allowed to go into certain restaurants or buildings or, you know, we are in a complete hypnosis to the panic still as we are, you know, as our government's telling us we're facing the Omicron variant. Tell us what's going on in the U.S. Give us some good news.
Well, as we sit here today, you know, it's the same viral pandemic. We're on the same continent. And, you know, I've just flown from Dallas-Fort Worth to Denver, Colorado. I'm on a ski trip right now. You can tell I'm casual and enjoying the time here. No vaccine required, no testing required to travel around the country. I'm able to go in and out of restaurants, no mask required. And life is free. Now, we clearly have faced the Omicron variant, and we're already through the big Omicron outbreak, and we're on the now back down to a baseline level. Two major realizations that have happened in the United States over the last year. First one is that COVID-19 is a treatable illness if multiple drugs are started early. And that message has gotten out through a whole series of publications. Then organizations have come on big. We have the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, the Truth for Health Foundation, Frontline Critical Care Consortium, the Unity Project, all of these American frontline doctors, all of these organizations support early treatment. There are literally dozens of telemedicine networks which help patients get medications. More primary care doctors are prescribing drugs. We have emergency use authorized monoclonal antibodies and now oral drugs. And so we're able to get through patients through the crisis. We know that only those who receive no early treatment or inadequate treatment end up in the hospital. Unfortunately, they're fewer and fewer. So this is all great news. Our big update is on January 23rd, we had a march against the mandates in Washington. It started at the Washington Monument, went all the way to the Lincoln Memorial. It was co-sponsored by multiple grassroots organizations. I gave the lead-off medical presentation to the group. It was a crowd of about 30 to 35,000 individuals, orderly group, perceptive, very appreciative. We heard speeches given by Del Bigtree, leader of the High Wire, and Robert F. Kennedy, leader of the Children's Health Defense. There were employment groups, nurses, firefighters, entertainers, Hi-Rez and Jimmy. So it was really a tremendous day. And then the next day we rolled into January 24th, historic U.S. Senate panel led by Senator Ron Johnson, co-moderated by myself. And it was titled COVID-19, A Second Opinion. We invited all the major public health officials and staffers to come. Sadly, none of them showed, but the press certainly did. We had a full gallery in the Senate caucus room, the Kennedy caucus room in the U.S. Senate building. We live streamed across major multiple networks. And we had 5 hours of testimony with no breaks. We had dozens of practicing physicians who had done research and learned how to treat COVID-19, PhDs, scientists, vaccine developers. We had patients, nurses, and attorneys. And so this was really a breakthrough panel. So in the last year, I can tell you, working very, very hard, I think United States clearly has made progress. And as a result of that, we're enjoying our freedoms and our rational approach to treating the pandemic.
Something you mentioned again off camera was that that first realization that COVID-19 is treatable has led to another realization, and that is that the vaccines that have been pushed out and rolled out are not effective or not safe in order for public policies to be made around them, or to government officials to be promoting them. Is it that secondary story that this Senate hearing was about?
The Senate hearing actually was structured around the four pillars of pandemic response, which I initially presented to the U.S. Senate in November of 2020. I subsequently published in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. And those four pillars are reducing the spread of the illness. So we had a dedication of time and comments to that. Pillar number two is early treatment. Pillar number three is hospital treatment. And pillar number four is vaccination. So it was a balanced testimony from multiple experts on what the pandemic response should have been. Our response should have always been based on the four pillars. In Canada, the same. We should have had experts in Washington on those four pillars. Canada should have had experts in Ottawa and across the provinces of Canada on those four pillars. And we should have monthly updates. You know, these public health servants, they serve us, and we demand a lot better than what we've had. And so our committee did not hold back any comments at all. We gave our full breadth of evidence-based comments, was cited in the literature. Senator Johnson did really a masterful job. The 5 hours of testimony is available on a whole variety of platforms. And now there's a 38-minute highlight reel, which I'll send over to you for your producers. I think everybody should watch it. It really has the key comments.
I would really look forward to watching that 38-minute highlight reel. So please do send that over. We'll make sure that we share that out. We might even attach it to this interview if we have your permission to do so.
Yeah, sure.
In that last hour about vaccine safety, I'm just looking at an article from The Defender, and it talks about spikes in miscarriages, neurological disorders, cancer, and other illnesses. Can you comment on that a little bit for us today?
Well, that was a surprise part of the meeting. It occurred in the last hour. And lead attorney Tom Rentz and co-counsel Lee Dundas came forward to the table. And they revealed three Department of Defense whistleblowers. The lead whistleblower is Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long. And they used the Department of Defense epidemiology database, where they have data on administration of the vaccines and the emergence of diseases among our million or more military personnel. And they had year-on-year data in disease categories. And it was a striking 2 to 3 to 4 to 5-fold increased risk plus in disease categories, including neurologic disease, cardiovascular, immunologic, hematologic, and as you pointed out, cancer. This was the first time that cancer epidemiologic data came forward, and there was an explosion of new cases. Those data were immediately legally requested by Senator Johnson before they could be altered or put in any other type of compromised position. We believe the military data may be key for us to understanding what chronic diseases COVID-19 vaccination is truly causing.
So how would you feel if the president of the United States was still on air, which he very well may be? I just haven't been keeping up with my Daily Wire this week, saying, look, get vaccinated. It's our only way out of this with these current safe vaccines, because that's really the position of our prime minister. Our prime minister a week and a half ago came on air and announced to the nation that he had contracted COVID-19, even though he was triple vaxxed, that he was asymptomatic and that he would be isolating in order to follow all of the health mandates. But after he gave that announcement, his response was literally, but I encourage every Canadian to get vaccinated. So you have someone who's apparently contracted the illness after being triple vaccinated, who doesn't have any symptoms. And his response is still to dig his heels into the ground as cement and say, get vaccinated. How do you respond to that, Dr. McCullough, as you are tracking with all of these different developments?
Physician scientist Robert Malone said it best on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He said, where there is risk, there must be choice. And it's clear, no public health servant or no government servant, even the president who serves us, you know, Trudeau serves you. The employment relationship is Trudeau works for you. Biden works for me. Someone who works for me doesn't bark a command to me on get vaccinated. You know, every medical product must be presented with risks and benefits. It has to. In fact, Trudeau is violating regulatory law. Biden is violating regulatory law. We have law that says we have the U.S. Truth in Advertising Act, the U.S. Drug and Cosmetic Act, and we have the Lemon Act that demands that Biden, who is a public health servant, who works for me and the American public, that Biden and any of his designees must present vaccines with risks and benefits, must be fair balance.
So now you've prepared a 5-point slide presentation, and I'm really interested to see it. So Ken, why don't you just go ahead and take us through this presentation? I believe you've just previously presented this to American frontline nurses. We're just so thankful that you put this information together for us.
Well, I put this together in my Beaver Creek condominium on my ski vacation as the kids were getting out the door for skiing. Can you see this okay, Michael?
I can see it great. This is okay. Perfect.
So this is the 5 COVID truths that I wanted to update the Canadian audience on. And by the way, people in my condominium are Canadian. So we're a split group. They're U.S. Canadian citizens. So here are the 5 COVID truths. So I can tell you I'm very invested in Canada being successful in pandemic response. So this is the shot of the Senate building where we held the second opinion, U.S. COVID-19 pandemic response. This is my second time testifying in the U.S. Senate. And I can tell you, I am grateful that we were able to get America's top scientists to get our voices in the U.S. Senate and have it in the Senate record. There is no substitute for working along proper governmental lines in doing that. And so this is a screenshot of America Out Loud Talk Radio, the McCullough Report, and this just hit the podcast system today. Apple, iHeart, all the major podcast networks. If you want to listen to the audio version of a few of the clips, now I put together those clips myself. They'll be slightly different than the YouTube video that I'll give you, which is a 38-minute audio and video summary. Here are the 5 COVID truths that I'd want you to know about, Michael. The first is, there is no asymptomatic spread. So Prime Minister Trudeau testing positive is, in a sense, an irrelevant event because the virus is not spread asymptomatically. Here are the 2 major papers. First one is by Shiying Cao from China. The second one is by Zachary Madewell, published in JAMA, both basically showing with very careful case contact tracing studies, large populations, these are published in the best journals, that asymptomatic spread does not happen. It was a false narrative that someone could be completely asymptomatic and give the virus to someone else. That means that lockdowns never needed to happen. Schools never needed to close. That means that we never needed to have restrictions. We never needed to put masks on people with no symptoms. All of those pandemic response measures were wrong because of a false assumption that the virus was the first illness in human history that spread from a completely asymptomatic person to a susceptible person. It was a wrong concept. These 2 papers were critical in setting it straight. Turns out Sweden was correct. Sweden never closed down anything, and they were correct. The second major point is asymptomatic testing is not supportable. The fact that your premier, in a very ill-advised manner, took a test with no symptoms is not supportable. It's not supportable by the US FDA, by Health Canada, by CDC, by the World Health Organization. Here are some recent data. This paper from Gans and colleagues, a large workplace study using rapid antigen tests, which are used in United Kingdom, Europe, Australia, New Zealand. The rapid antigen test, 903,408 asymptomatic rapid antigen test done at 537 workplaces, it generated 0.15 positive results. That tells you it is a giant waste of time in hundreds of thousands of individuals. And the number of false positive results was 42% of the entire group. I mean, meaning they couldn't even back it up with a PCR. And even the PCR test itself is likely to be false positive when no one has symptoms. So this paper by Gans gives one the conclusion that an asymptomatic test is a waste of time. This paper from Akashi and colleagues from the Olympics found that the rate, they screened everybody in the Olympic Village, the rate of being confirmed positive was 0.44%, and there was no significant clinical illness reported in this study. Again, the vast majority of people undergoing these tests are completely wasting their time, and it's not supportable. It's the reason why the regulatory agencies don't support asymptomatic testing. These are two recent papers.
Which regulatory agencies don't? Because we are having asymptomatic testing all across our nation.
Take a look at Health Canada. I bet they don't support it. I can tell you the US FDA, which clears diagnostic tests, haven't cleared a single diagnostic test for asymptomatic screening. All the tests are only indicated to use in acutely symptomatic individuals.
So why is it that the practice on the ground is so far out from...
It's out of regulatory bounds. That's the reason why we're talking about it. It's out of regulatory bounds. Listen, the airlines are still testing people. It's not supported. That is basically an unindicated test. And so we can't do tests that aren't indicated by our health regulatory authorities. We can't do it. It's an overreach.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next point is natural immunity protects against severe disease. And I don't have time to go through the exhaustive, about 150 papers supporting natural immunity, but all the way from the wild type through the Delta variant, patients didn't get COVID-19 a second time, and they certainly didn't end up on the ventilator two and three times. It was one illness, and that was it. The Omicron variant broke through natural immunity, so someone who had a previous variant could get Omicron, but it was very brief, it was very mild, and Omicron's been characterized as Mother Nature's natural booster. I've said that on national TV, as well as COVID expert Dr. Martin McCreary from Johns Hopkins. This recent paper was published from Johns Hopkins just on February 3rd, using a high-quality antibody assay against the receptor binding domain of a large sample. And you can see here that of those who were COVID recovered and they knew they had the illness, 99% had antibodies many months after the infection. Of those with suspected COVID-19, 55% had antibodies present. And those even who didn't have any COVID-19, they also had antibodies present. So again, it just supports the concept that someone who's COVID recovered, for instance, that is a very solid clinical claim. Anybody listening to this who've had COVID, they don't need to go out and prove their immunity. They have immunity against severe illness, COVID-19. And even Scott Atlas, who's a former White House Task Force member under President Trump, and he's a frequent contributor to Fox News on my team, Scott has said that denial of natural immunity by the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the vaccine mandate is unprecedented in modern history. And so this is a strong call that all government agencies, all employers, all schools, all basically community bodies should recognize natural immunity. Once someone's been through the illness, they should receive absolutely no forms of pressure or coercion, or they shouldn't receive any type of mandates being pressured into any type of activity. Once someone's been through the illness, it basically should be a free course from that point forward with no other mention of COVID-19 in their lives. Fourth point. COVID-19 is a treatable illness, as we mentioned. These are the two seminal publications that I led showing doctors how COVID-19 can be treated early in the course of disease. We took the precautionary principle. We said it was a mass casualty event. We weren't going to wait for large randomized trials. We look for drugs and continue to look for drugs that have a signal of benefit from all the evidence, acceptable safety, and we don't expect single drugs to completely cure COVID-19. We use drugs in combination to reduce the intensity and duration of symptoms, and via that mechanism, reduce the risks of hospitalization and death. And this model, which has been presented in the US Senate in November of 2020, and I've published it subsequently, points out that it's a long illness. It lasts for about 30 days. Mortality starts to go up at 14 days. We have a long course of viral proliferation with its characteristic signs and symptoms. We have cytokine injury that shades in over the first few days. That's inflammation, cough and difficulty breathing start. And when there's oxygen desaturation and chest heaviness and pain, that's actually microthrombosis in the lungs. And when patients die of COVID-19, they uniformly have micro blood clots in the lungs. So our treatment response is the use of intracellular anti-infectives and antiviral antibodies, corticosteroids and immunomodulators, and antiplatelet drugs and anticoagulants. This is called framework for what's considered the McCullough Protocol. This has been copyrighted now on my behalf by Dr. Ben Marble at myfreedoctor.com. Ben testified that this protocol has been used in nearly 200,000 Americans and has had nearly perfect results in terms of avoiding hospitalization and death. So let's go through it. When somebody gets COVID-19 at home, they self-quarantine, they start povidone iodine nasal washes 6 times a day, and we'll get into this. This is new research. We do contact tracing, contagion control, ventilate, fresh air, reduce the re-inoculation. Age under 50, we now recommend an OTC bundle, over-the-counter bundle, zinc, vitamin D at a high dose, now vitamin C, quercetin, 500 milligrams twice a day, and famotidine, 80 milligrams a day. That's an over-the-counter medication to reduce viral replication. Watchful waiting, and if completing the self-quarantine, the CDC now recommends a shortened 5-day course of quarantine for asymptomatic people. We apply that to symptomatic people, provided the last 2 days they're free of fever. The Omicron variant is a very rapid syndrome, and it's much shorter than the prior strains. The age over 50 with medical problems, obesity, lung disease, diabetes, kidney disease, heart disease, cancer. There, we would consider sotrovimab and monoclonal antibody infusion. That's the remaining monoclonal antibody that should target the Omicron variant and high-risk individuals. I've used it a few times in my practice, but largely people in their 80s who are very frail. If we can't use monoclonal antibodies, we use two or more intracellular anti-infective agents. Hydroxychloroquine based on over 300 studies, ivermectin based on over 70 studies. And now we have Paxlovid, the new Pfizer drug, or molnupiravir, the new Merck drug. We can combine it with azithromycin and doxycycline to cover some other organisms. We use inhaled budesonide throughout, oral colchicine throughout. We can use oral prednisone or dexamethasone on day 5, or if pulmonary symptoms set in, we use aspirin 325 milligrams per day per hour. Then we use anticoagulants in high-risk individuals. Now, age over 50 with one or more comorbidities on the right, we tend to consolidate things. I'm finding with Omicron that I have to consolidate the ivermectin and prednisone almost simultaneously. We use home oxygen at home. And now at this point in time, we rarely send people to the hospital. We're very comfortable managing oxygen saturations in the 80, provided the shortness of breath is reasonable and there's good mentation. So we don't rely on the hospital at all. We think the outpatient strategy will work. We recognize in Canada that you have limitations to a lot of these products, but I think the OTC bundle is still well within your capabilities in Canada, the povidone iodine washes, and then the use of oral prednisone, colchicine, and some of the drugs farther down in the program. Now, this paper was just published by Fazio and colleagues. I was one of the authors, showing that the first 3 days is the golden window for treatment in terms of reducing the intensity, severity, and duration of symptoms, and that we feature now the use of povidone iodine. I think every Canadian household ought to have this brown sterilization liquid. It's about $5 on Amazon. This is my kitchen countertop. The dilution is 1/2 teaspoon and 1.5 ounces of water, a shot glass or a little cup like this. It should be the consistency of dark tea over the sink, either squirt it up with a bulb or spray it up with a nasal spray bottle, up the nose, sniff it back, and then spit it out the mouth. That do it twice on each side, gargle with the rest. That's an adequate wash. That is very effective in killing the Omicron variant. The Omicron replicates 70 times faster than Delta. It causes the fever and all the symptoms right out of the nasal cavity. So the Omicron, everyone is interested in pills or other systemic therapy. Omicron is best treated with local virucidal therapy. Now, if one can't tolerate iodine, you can use a dilute hydrogen peroxide. The dilution is 3/4 teaspoon in a shot glass of water, same approach. Now, in the pivotal clinical trial done by Chaudhary and colleagues, you can see how these nasal washes, povidone iodine, knocked down the PCR test very quickly by day 3, 5, and 7 compared to a control group. And then you can see the need for hospitalization, oxygen, or death is dramatically reduced. This is a high quality prospective randomized trial. This is probably the biggest news that's come out in COVID-19 in 2021. And it's used widely now across the world. In the United States, we use this It really has dramatic effects. I've used it in even someone up to 98 years old in my practice. This is the home-based COVID-19 treatment guide. It's been updated by Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. That's one of the older physician groups in the United States, chartered in every state. It contains all the information I mentioned. Please go to aapsonline.org to download it. And then my final point is that vaccines are not sufficiently safe or effective. We've seen a massive Omicron outbreak. There are no randomized trials showing that the vaccines had any acceptable coverage for either the Delta nor the Omicron variant at this point in time. The World Health Organization has cast doubt on boosters. The vaccine manufacturers have stated that the vaccines don't cover Omicron, and therefore they're trying to come up with new vaccines to cover Omicron. And then in terms of safety, this published paper in the peer-reviewed literature shows that in terms of vaccine adverse event reports of Americans living in the United States is unacceptably high in 2021. You can see a skyrocketing in the left panel. And then in the right panel, the deaths are unacceptably high. All vaccines combined per year, about 150 deaths, as you can see, 2011 through 2020. 2021, through this date of reporting, we had 6,639 Americans who died. Now the current number is approximately 21,000 Americans in the open VAERS system, which is about 90% domestic. This slide alone tells the listeners that the vaccines are not sufficiently safe to use or promote or mandate in our society. Sadly, in the
United States— Dr. McCullough, can you just go back to that slide and just, on that slide, the number of deaths in 2021 is 6,639.
Right, but that's of a data cutoff that was in the summer, because this has to go through peer review.
Great. Okay, so just the difference between that number and the 21,000 is that
it's time. It's time. Number one, this was strictly restricted to U.S. reporting,
and then it was cut off in September 2021.
No, and now you're saying it was cut off before that. It was published in September 2021. It was cut off midsummer. Takes several months to publish. So I'm going to get to the most recent number here coming up. But okay. I wanted to let you know that the backdrop here is 220 million Americans out of the 330 million Americans patriotically did take a vaccine. We've had a recent work group meeting in Wichita, Kansas, where the doctors believe about half of patients took the vaccines because of perceived health benefits. The other half felt as if they were forced into it and they actually didn't want to take the vaccines. Now, here's the most recent report you're asking about, Michael, January 28th. We're now up to 23,149 deaths. The open VAERS system, which is an overlay query system, indicates that 90% of these cases are domestic US, 10% are ex-US, and that we have over 350,000 hospitalization, urgent care visits, or doctor visits due to vaccine injuries. 41,163 are permanently disabled. Sadly, 31,185 have had myocarditis, pericarditis, of which there's official FDA warnings on. You can see that in the lower panel, the real peak time for these events to occur is within typically the first week after receiving the vaccine. And on the right side of the panel, you can see the different organ injury syndromes. The brain, the heart, the autonomic nervous system, the GI tract, muscle, joint pain, muscle spasms, peripheral neuropathies. The medical literature now, if we consider the preprint server system, has over 1,000 papers on vaccine injury syndromes, over 200 papers on vaccine-induced myocarditis. There simply is a torrent of data on vaccine injury syndromes now. And the data are consistent with what's seen in the yellow card system and what's seen in the European UDRA system. This paper by Pantazatos and Seligman is on the ResearchGate preprint server. This is the same preprint system the National Institutes of Health uses. And here they took US Census data and vaccine administration data and estimated how many lives could have been lost due to the COVID-19 vaccines. And they estimate from 0 to 20 weeks post-injection, we could have lost as many as 187,000 Americans due to the vaccines. Now, this is an ecological analysis, and we understand now that the actuarial life insurance data have been reported in the United States, there's been a 40% increase shift in terms of deaths age 18 to 49 in the United States. And it's not due to COVID-19 respiratory illness. The only thing that's changed in our country is the administration of COVID-19 vaccines done on an indiscriminate basis. We know the vaccines have a dangerous mechanism of action. They use genetic material to basically trick our body cells into producing the dangerous and lethal Wuhan spike protein, which is known to be injurious to organs and results in death. I mean, this is now accepted. And a recent report out of the Netherlands has also found a dramatic upward shift in actuarial mortality. Anything more than a 10% shift is considered dramatic. So my call to action here is that we should end all lockdowns and restrictions based on the fact that the virus does not spread asymptomatically and asymptomatic testing is not supportable. We should only test on the label of the products in acutely ill patients, period. We should recognize natural infections in all applications. The naturally immune should not have any considerations of COVID-19 in their lives because they've already been through the illness. We should treat COVID-19 early in high-risk individuals. That remains our primary goal. There'll be, with the Omicron, such a mild syndrome, we'll have relatively few numbers of people to treat with medications, and that's true in my clinical practice. We should drop all vaccine mandates and pause the current products. There have been multiple calls worldwide since March to pull these vaccines off the market because of the observation that people are dying after their administration and they're receiving grievous organ injury syndromes, and some of them who survive are now permanently disabled. Those are my comments, and I'll stop here.
Wow, thank you for sharing that with us, Peter. I have a non-technical question, and that is, how are you keeping up with all of this? You must have teams working on this day and night.
We have good teams. We've organized loosely into teams that work worldwide, and it's been extremely helpful. We have a very strong presence in social media, and we've done well, I think, in messaging to America and to the world these fundamental observations. Now everybody has an idea about what's going on. We're holding large public programs across the United States. Myself and groups of doctors, we meet individually or in teams, typically with practicing physician lawmakers and with big public programs. And about 500 to 5,000 people attend for these large gatherings. And so it's impossible to censor the scientific truth.
Yeah, you segued into something that I wanted to ask you about on the censorship issue. How many Canadian mainstream media outlets have asked you to do an interview?
I can't recall. So, I mean, your major ones would be
CBC, CTV, Global.
I would say none, Michael.
And then just on that censorship, you mentioned Robert Malone and his speech at that last rally that you all held. Joe Rogan is getting criticized for having Robert Malone on and spreading misinformation. And are you still facing that same type of censorship and attack personally on, you know, being a spreader of misinformation, or are you seeing a turn happen?
Yeah, I've never had a direct, attack or a direct conversation where someone felt that I made a point that wasn't well supported in the data. And just as I did here today, I constantly cite the data, first author. I'm very careful. When I went to Joe Rogan, I prepared for a month. I used continuing medical education certified slides that have been certified in a major scientific meeting. And I opened up my computer and I stuck to the data. And Joe Rogan was a very fair journalist. He was perceptive, intelligent. And then afterwards, there were numerous write-ups. And I simply said, listen, I just follow the slides. Spotify never asked for my slides. President Biden, through Press Secretary Jen Psaki, mentioned that big tech should censor Joe Rogan. You know, the White House never asked for my slides. No one actually ever asked to look at the data. So they can't possibly know what's information or misinformation. We just look at the scientific data like we did today. So that's where we are right now. I think what's prevailing is scientific truth. Americans know and understand when someone's being truthful to them.
I think the one thing that whenever you and I speak, I always want to connect is that scientific truth has to jive with morality. It has to jive with, I don't want to say common sense, in the sense that sometimes common sense isn't as common as we would hope it would be. But those last five observations that you shared, I think you and I would have been able to come to many of those a year ago when we were talking, simply because science doesn't get a free rein to just break all of the previous historical laws and developments that we've gone through and learned when previous individuals would use their scientific inquiry to, you know, maybe nebulous, nefarious types of behaviors. Would you say that you've been encouraged again to just see how consistent your findings have been now that the data, I won't say the data is changing, but now that the data is more available?
You know, Dan Bongino recently on Fox News a few days ago had me on. He showed a montage of clips of statements made by our public health officials and by major media, statements that were clear misinformation. For instance, they stated that the vaccine stops the virus in its tracks. Our president said the vaccines would never be mandated, that the vaccines stop transmission. You know, all these incorrect statements. I'm really glad I didn't make incorrect statements. I've been very careful. Now, I tend to be conservative, and I did understate the size and the implications of the Delta outbreak, and I did understate the dominance of what the Omicron outbreak was. But I'd rather be conservative and then keep up with the data as it emerges than jump out there and make completely incorrect statements.
Well, Dr. McCullough, I just want to thank you for your time. I know you're on holidays and I want to let you get back to your family. We really appreciate this. And man, some of those slides that you showed, I hope that they can go viral, because, you know, I said to my wife this morning, I'm interviewing Dr. McCullough. What do you want me to ask him? And she said, Michael, you have to ask him about the VAERS report, because there's just so much information coming out of that. She wanted to ask about the DOD investigation, because, you know, that's a major story. And so I just,
Yeah, let me provide some commentary about it. The reason why it's so important is the VAERS is self-reported data, but it's actually 86% of the time it's reported by doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers, about 14% by patients themselves. With death, it's obviously the family must report it, you know, in this minority of cases. With the Department of Defense, it's a clinical system. There's no self-reporting. It's simply they know who got the vaccine and they know who got illness. So the two systems are very complementary.
Well, you are giving hope, and you are giving what I would say real second opinion medical advice to citizens all over our nations. And I'm thankful for it. I do think of women like my wife, who are competent, caring mothers who want to have the best information in hand in order to make the decision for their children. I think of fathers and you know, guys who are going to work. I'm thinking of the truckers right now. So any information that they are getting that is honest and transparent has been a real treasure. And you've been a real voice of that good information. So thank you so much, Dr. McCullough. God bless you as you go, and have a great vacation with your family.
Thank you.